Keith, this is Sunday night, and this is Tech Dash. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also be hearing a few other guys. Paul, WS2N, John, KC2WGB, Hal, K60PZ. That's a group of guys does most of the organizing of this thing. Primary purpose, as you guys have heard so many times, is education. We amateurs get together and we attempt to educate each other about the 26 different kinds of ham radio. The usual menu is the first hour or so we take in people who sign in only with a question or a comment for the net. Need you sign in. Need that sign in because you're listening. TechNet number 1,493 of the last 31 years of TechNet. Let me drop. It's been 31 years of TechNet, so by now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. And I'm not going to do that mysterious thing that people do for traditional reasons whenever they run a net. The very first thing they ask is there any emergency traffic? It never is. I'm not quite sure why they do that. All right, a person signs in by giving John, Hal, Paul, and Dick, giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So we have an issue. I can give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW listening. Okay, we get the... I did get rich. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
We got you, Neil. Anyone else?
With the space report. And I also have a question that Dapper question, and good evening to everybody on the net.
Okay, we got Paul with both a space report and a check-in question. We got Neil, KC2, Charlie, Mike, Quebec. Anyone else? Give me a call that is a name right now. And one of the things that we have to repeat rather frequently is that if you go to reverse mode on your transceiver, in other words, you're listening to the input frequency 146.25, whatever you hear, or give us the time that you heard it, where you were located, particularly if you were mobile, where you were located, what you heard, how strong was it, if you happen to have a directional antenna, what direction it came from. So tell us what you hear, and report that to rfi@limarc.org, Radio Frequency Interference is what that stands for, RFI at Limarc, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club is what that stands for, .org. So give us those reports. It'll help locate the individual that's doing this. Alrighty, anyone else check in with the TechNet? Give me a call letters and name right now. KQRIW listening. Anyone else check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
NY-2-8-7.
Yes.
H, or was it NY-2-HF? Was that Lou or Dennis? Jen, C2R, I'll be listening. Microwave site of Well, listen, I can't figure. Tom Williams. At the bottom of his page, you'll see Yagi information, impedance matching information by KQRAW. You click on that button, and you'll see three things there. A 1,500-word article describing how to get perfect impedance matching of a dipole, or the dipole that's part of a Yagi, for instance. And you'll also see the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. One curve is, let me drop. One curve is the resistive component of impedance versus length, and the other curve is the reactive component of impedance versus length. But each one of those graphs has about 15 separate graphs superimposed, and each one of those graphs are for different diameters. So when you look at that data, you'll see very rapidly that the rate at which the impedance changes versus length, which is really bandwidth, goes down drastically as the ratio of diameter to length starts becoming a bigger number. The very first curve there is a 1,000-to-1 ratio. By the way, when you and I use a piece of 14-gauge wire to make an 80-meter dipole, we've got a 20,000-to-1 ratio of diameter to length. So it's a very skinny wavelength diameter type thing. Let me drop. And as you stare at those curves, you'll rapidly recognize the fact that the rate of change of resistance slows down a little bit as a function of the diameter. However, the rate of change of reactance really slows down in a hurry. And as you start making the radiator wider and wider, I'll admit that on 80 meters it's not easy to do. You could make a cage dipole, in other words, mobile wires parallel to each other, and you could fool the signal into thinking you've got a large diameter. But if you're at a VHF, UHF frequency, where I've done a whole lot of work at 900 megacycles, for instance, and I was making Yagis out of sheet metal, where the director and the reflector and the exhibit element was just a cut-out piece of sheet metal, and the dipole itself of the 900 meg Yagi was something in the vicinity of 4.5 inches long, but I made it something in the vicinity of 3/4 of an inch wide out of copper. Copper sheeting, and you could also do it with copper foil. When you do that, you get a huge improvement in the bandwidth versus standing wave ratio. As I said, the books do not cover it very well. However, let me drop. That data has been hidden in plain sight for, let me think, 65 years. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward spent a man year of their life gathering that data. They built a whole bunch of monopoles on a great big ground plane with various diameters and various lengths, and they made the measurement the hard way for the slotted line and measuring the positions of the nulls and the peaks and using a slide rule. And every time you do 10 minutes worth of calculation, you get one dot on the curve, and each one of those curves has got 1,000 dots, if you know what I mean. So it's a lot of work, but that is real hardcore measured data. Traceable to the Bureau, if you know what I mean, right from the horse's mouth, hidden in plain sight since 1945. That's when they did that work. That's when they first published it. Every single issue of the 4 issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook has that data. What is amazing to me is that data, so widely available, is not discussed in any schools. And when you take the major meeting that was held by the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE on Long Island, December 8th of 2013, that meeting took at the, what used to be called Hazeltine Corporation, is now called BAE, in Huntington, Northport, I guess you would call it, Huntington, right along Pulaski Avenue, Pulaski Drive. In that meeting, I could tell by the discussions that took place, people had not made that data available to them, and they were propagating information that was lacking that information. And I started asking questions about, have you considered the Brown and Woodward curves in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook? And each of the antenna engineers in the audience, plus the speaker, asked me, what chapter is that? And I was amazed. They hadn't become aware of it. So you see those curves. And as I said, it's It's not super obvious at first, but there's a tremendous amount of hidden information there. And as you make the dipole larger and larger in diameter, let me drop, the bandwidth definitely increases. By using super wide bandwidth, there was a particular antenna that I was building at 915 megacycles for a commercial application, where with ordinary techniques, skinny wire-like elements for the three-element Yagi, the Yagi would have had a bandwidth of something in the vicinity of 10 or 15 megahertz. I used very wide sheet metal techniques. The antenna became 99% efficient, displayed all the gain you could ever get out of a three-element Yagi, 6 and a fraction dB over ISO, and instead of 15 megahertz of bandwidth, it had 150 megahertz of bandwidth, and throughout that whole bandwidth, the standing wave ratio was less than 1.2 to 1. So is there an advantage of wide? Absolutely. On the UHF frequencies, it's easy to do. On HF, I'll admit it's difficult. But if you can do it, it's a whole area that has not been properly addressed, not properly researched. The computer modeling programs can't handle it. It's one of the reasons they don't go there. And you've hit on an extremely good subject, Neil. Hidden to almost everybody. You now know the secret. There's a tremendous advantage when you go there. I wonder if it's a surprise to you. And what made you start asking the question in the first place? Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Quebec. K2RI 3 in the TechNet.
Hopefully you can hear me. It's always made sense to me that a larger conductor would move more electrons along the surface and give you more of an output, and also be able to have a larger area to basically capture whatever's coming in. However, the other question I had real quickly is, if I was making a Yagi, is there a penalty to pay in efficiency or however, or rather, let me word it this way, is it best to make both the dipole, the reflectors, and the reflectors all the same diameter, or can you play with those diameters to get better results? Over.
See where you're going with this one now. Let's see if I'm getting through. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, all's well. And you're coming through very well, Neil. You've made an extremely logical conclusion that a wider element antenna has more area, therefore it's going to capture more signal. Good common sense. Dead wrong. The capture area of an antenna is a function of its horizontal width. In the case of a horizontally polarized dipole, it's the resonance that gives you all of the effective cover area. If you carefully measure the gain of a dipole that's a 1,000-to-1 ratio in diameter to length versus a 4-to-1 ratio of diameter to length, the gain would be identical, the pattern would be identical. You don't pick up more gain, even though your eye sees more area. However, you pick up a tremendous improvement in bandwidth. The gain comes from the fact that there is a driven element radiating in a dipole-like manner. It's sending out a signal, and your parasitic elements pick up that signal and re-radiate it. Turns out that every antenna you put anywhere in the world will pick up a certain amount of signal. Some of it is sent down the transmission line. Some of it's re-radiated in space. A simple dipole, from one point of view, made out of perfect material, you could say runs a 50% efficiency. For all the energy that your dipole picks up, half of it goes down the feed line, half of it gets re-radiated back into space. You can't stop it from doing that. So by comparison to the most efficient antenna you can build, it is 100% efficient. But if you really dig down and get to the really basic physics, a dipole runs 50% efficient. A horn, by the way, runs higher efficiency. We will go there right now, because it's an omnidirectional, a one-directional device. Now, those parasitic elements will give you the directivity you desire, the front-to-back ratio, the front-to-side ratio, if each one of the parasitic elements has the right resonant frequency and they're located in the right position. There's a huge advantage in making your reflector and director also large in diameter, because you again pick up this huge bandwidth improvement. Let me drop. You pick up this huge bandwidth improvement. Okay, wait a minute now. Oh, there it is. Gotta keep changing my controls. And the only slight disadvantage is that when you make the parasitic element fatter to be back on the right resonant frequency, usually you got to make it a little bit shorter. So if you're taking somebody's well-respected design and just making a fatter version of it, once you do a careful tuning job, you will discover that you have to make the element a little bit shorter. And there is a way of calculating that. But as long as you're using low-loss materials, even skinny wire can run 98% efficiency. Fat sheet metal type elements on UHF, you can have 99.99% efficiency, if you know what I mean. The current density becomes so low, you could almost make the conductors out of carbon granules and it still would work like a charm. So once you've done that retuning, all the gain comes back. Because, as I said, what Yagi is, a number of parasitic elements have the right resonant frequency and they're located at the right position in space. You would think that the fatter elements are going to create shadow. Well, if you've ever seen the so-called Simone antenna or the cigar antenna, where the parasitic element, the driven element, and the reflector are all made out of round metallic discs, great big washers, so to speak. By common sense, you can assume that those forward directors are going to cast huge shadow onto the driven element. Good common sense. Doesn't work that way. Radio-wise, the signal looks at whether or not the great big washer up front is the right resonant frequency. It doesn't see the width. That doesn't create shadow. It's getting back to the point that your dipole has 50% efficiency. In other words, of all the energy that hits it, half of it gets re-radiated. That's exactly what's happening with that director up front. It is re-radiating, in that case, all of the energy that hits it, because there is no feed line connected to it sucking up that energy. So that energy is going to be re-radiated, and you think it has to create a shadow? It absolutely doesn't. Playing around with Yagis is a weird mixture of things that make sense and things that don't make sense. But once you get the kind of an antenna range, you'd be amazed what you can do with Yagis. Neil, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I'm not hearing the four beeps, so hopefully you can hear me. Thanks, Dick. I'll pass it on to someone else now. Thank you very much.
Are we out, Dick? The four beeps tonight, you know, and everything you said came through like a charm. You're in the back yard of the repeater, so you put in a gangbuster signal. Okay, I did hear Rich sign in more time. Let's give it another try here, Rich. And to Echo Oscar, K2R. By the way, Neil, as you do further experimenting with fat elements of any kind, whether it be Yagi, dipole, J-pole, whatever, come back and tell us what you find. Rich, now take it again. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
How are we getting into the repeater, okay?
You just asked me, how are you getting into the repeater? Is it okay? And the answer is yes. Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yeah, well, I wanted to bring up, let's do a talk, and get some more information on something. Things dealing with astronomy. Cousin, her name is Amy, and she knows how to find. Turns out she works of a job as a pupil from the it's now called Rose Planetarium. Let me let it reset. Okay, they. carry him with a star chart and all the stuff I need. Because she's going to go over there this week on her lunch hour. She said, don't even question, Dick. They call it now the Rose Planetarium. I wonder if that name is named after Rose Kennedy. Because there's a Rose Center. Did you get that, Dick?
I did get that. And what you're discussing now is the so-called Rose Center of the Hayden Planetarium, which is connected to the Museum of Natural History. I think it's called the Rose Center because a family named Rose made a very large financial contribution to what was called the Hayden Planetarium, and it's still called the Hayden Planetarium. But they did a lot of renovating. And so if you visited the Hayden Planetarium 20 years ago, and if you visited it in the last 10 years, there was a huge improvement, a huge amount of renovation. Yes, each of the times that I visited the Rose Center or Hayden Planetarium, they've got a very nice astronomy store connected to it, which sells lots and lots of astronomy books and other kinds of astronomy stuff, like the star chart, the kinds of star charts that rotate. Let me drop them. Okay, somebody said that comment. I'll pick you up in a minute. So lots of star charts, lots of books, things like that. Now, I know that Amy is going to be going there for you, and you'd like to know what should she buy. And that's not an easy one to answer. The man who runs the astronomy net every other Thursday night, I think he's the one that's going to check in, and he's going to make some suggestions for you, I believe. So I like that the 18-inch diameter, great big plastic touch chart thing where you dial in the hour of the day and the day of the year, and it shows you what the sky will look like. I like that one. Not everybody does. There's lots of computer programs that help an awful lot. There's lots of books that help a lot. My favorite book is by Baker, Introduction to Astronomy. Not everyone agrees with me on that one. Let's see, who was that just signed in and want to make a comment on astronomy? Give me a call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. And when I pass it over to you, you won't hear beeps. So wait for the four beeps, so to speak, time for the four beeps, but you won't hear the four beeps. Go ahead, that person, K2RIW.
KD2CXK, it is Craig who runs the astronomy net.
Yes.
They donated all the money. So you're looking, you're describing the planet speaker, and I love them. So get one, and what size work do I have a little? But they're bucks.
Making suggestions for which as to what he should buy, perhaps of his representative by at the astronomy store at the Rose Center Hayden Planetarium. Give me a call, that is right now. KQRIW, the Tech Man.
Well, I'll try Echo Link, Dick. It's Craig, KD2CXK. I hope I can get through on this one. What is exactly you... ...in... ...front, but, ...college of...
Planets. And have you been checking with NASA recently? In the last week or so, let me drop. In the last week, they discovered a planet that goes around its star and it wobbles. At first you say, how in the world can it wobble? Well, it's not going around one star. First of all, our particular star that we call the Sun happens to be a unary star, a star all by itself. There's a hell of a lot of binary stars out there, two separate stars going around each other. There are more binaries than unaries. And the astronomers used to think, by their mathematical modeling and whatever, that you couldn't get a stable planet going around a binary star system. Well, Kepler discovered some number of planets going around binary star systems. So what you thought couldn't happen, did happen, is happening. Astronomy as I see it, you dig deeper and deeper into it, it is stranger than you could possibly imagine. No matter how strange you think the universe is, you dig a little deeper, you find it stranger yet. No matter how big you think something is, Mother Nature's got a bigger one you'll discover someday. No matter how bright it is, Mother Nature's got a brighter one you're going to discover someday. No matter what you think is impossible, you're going to find one of the possible things someday. I bet you've got a couple of opinions on this one, Craig. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie X-ray Kilo. Keep your eyes on the TechNet.
I retire, I can open up a business that does carting and rubbish removal, primarily book recycling, and all I have to do is place dumpsters outside of every astrophysics department in the country, if not the world, and they'll fill them with books, because that's how fast the books are being rewritten on all of this. What we knew 20 years ago is not what we knew 10 years ago, and it's definitely not what we're learning in the past few years. So it's a very exciting time. For the people who think that there's just about everything's been discovered, boy, are they wrong. This is the forefront now. It was stagnant for a while, but now technology has let it catch up, and everything's about to bust wide open in the next 25 years. It's a very exciting time to be alive. As far as Rich is concerned, just look up. You see something that grabs your fancy, look it up. The internet is free for time being, except getting on it, and all that information is there. You want to do any reading, you can do it online, you can go buy books. But I say first get excited, then learn about what excites you. K2
okay. Vic and Tulio.
Very fine, Greg. You came beautifully. And Rich wanted to add something. Go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. First of all, dumb question. Am I getting over that, Dick? Am I getting over that, Dick?
Go right ahead and ask your question. And just to be double down sure, ask it twice. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. A planisphere. I'm not sure what that is. Is that disc that rotates and gives you the four seasons on it, that you see the stars, the four seasons? Is that what a planisphere is?
There is, yes, Rich. A planisphere, it really has, at least the one that I bought from Barnes & Noble, and I'm pretty sure the Rose Center is going to sell something similar. The main disk is 18 inches in diameter, and all the stars that are possibly observable throughout the year in the northern hemisphere are on the main disk. There's a second disk on top of it where you rotate one versus the other. By way of the markings on the outer perimeter, you select the day of the year, the month and the day of the year, and the hour at which you're doing observing. You set those numbers on the perimeter. The second disc on top has got an oval shape to it. The oval shape covers up a portion, I'm going to make a guess, roughly 50%. It covers up roughly 50% of the main disc of all the stars you could possibly see any time during the year. During any one hour and any one day and any one time of the year, there's only a certain percentage of those stars that are above your horizon. therefore that oval on the second disc on top covers up the ones that you're not going to see at this hour on this day. And then the ones that are left over, you'll see them inside of that oval, if you know what I mean. Those are the ones that are observable to you on that day. Very handy chart, just like Craig said. It doesn't require batteries. It never runs down. It's got all kinds of beautiful illustrations on the back as well as the front. A lot of written information on the back, handy data on the back. And on the front, you can decide that, hey, I'm going to be going to a dark area on my vacation 3 months from now, and I'm going to be looking at 9 o'clock at night. You can dial that in and find out from that vacation dark spot what are you going to be able to see. That planisphere will show that to you. But if that makes a little bit more sense now, Rich, you've probably seen one of these things before, just that no one used the same name for it, so to speak, and therefore you weren't sure. N2 Echo Walker, K2RIW in the second act.
Yes, Dick, but I was a child. As a child, I had one of those. I do remember what it was. I do remember it. And I don't know, I think we'll go on to somebody else in a minute. I don't want to hog this, but Dick, one thing I did want to ask you, you know, I became crippled in the last year or so, and I haven't developed the skills yet needed to get around properly in a wheelchair, so to get to the Rose Center Planetarium would be very difficult for me. Now, you said there's a planetarium out on Long Island. Where is it, and where can I find it on the Internet? Is it as good as the Hayden Planetarium? And also, in the summer, would I be able to get to one of the places where you guys do the observation at night where it's good and dark? As you know, I don't know if Craig knows, I was given a Meade 100-millimeter telescope. It's a Meade reflector telescope. Back to Ned and to Leo.
Very fine, Rich. And to EO, K2RIW. So you've got a Meade 100-millimeter telescope, and that's not a bad beginning. Or binoculars, and maybe you're going to want to do both. When it comes to the East Coast planetariums, bar none, about the very best one is the Hayden Planetarium, so-called Rose Center, located at the Museum of Natural History in Manhattan. That's obviously the best one. The second best one, arguably, is Vanderbilt Planetarium. Vanderbilt Planetarium is in Centerport. Centerport is on the north shore of Long Island, just east of Huntington. And both the Vanderbilt Planetarium and the Rose Center, I'm reasonably sure both of them are handicapped equipped, if you know what I mean. They got ramps and so on, so that if you are a wheelchair person and somebody's wheeling you around or you can propel yourself, I'm reasonably sure that both of those places can accommodate you. The one in Centerport, let me drop. The one in Centerport, which is the Vanderbilt Planetarium, is a little bit smaller than Hayden. Both the planetarium itself is a little bit smaller, not quite as many people can squeeze in there. And the store is not quite as big. However, they do have on campus a very nice, large telescope that after they give a lecture, people can look through that telescope. Another real good place where you can look through a telescope is at the open night astronomy forums that are held at Stony Brook University. Stony Brook also is handicapped equipped. And the very first Friday of the month during the school year, Stony Brook, and you can go to their website. You got to fiddle around a little bit with the website to find it. But the astronomy open night at Stony Brook University is in their number one lecture hall in the Earth and Space Science Center. That lecture hall can hold 300 people sitting. And with
the Vanderbilt
one, have a place to park a car.
People.
Let me drop.
Dick, does the Vanderbilt one have a place to park a car?
Absolutely. Vanderbilt has a nice big parking lot. The only slight disadvantage is that the parking lot is not too close to the planetarium. For us people who are who are peripatetic, not challenged, those who can walk around, no problem. You've got to walk about a block between the parking lot and the planetarium. That represents a little bit of a problem for a handicapped person. But do they have a parking lot? Absolutely. They have to have. Huntington Town wouldn't allow you to set up anything for public access without first proving to them you've got a big enough parking lot in your plans. So, Vanderbilt Planetarium. You had another question there, Barry? Okay. It's another very good planetarium. The biggest astronomy group, let me drop it.
WS2N, Tana.
Paul recognized the biggest astronomy group on Long Island, from my point of view, is ASLI, Astronomical Society of Long Island. They hold their meetings every single Wednesday at 8:30 for about an hour at the Vanderbilt Planetarium in Centerport, Long Island, every single Wednesday night. That club is so enthusiastic. They don't hold their meetings once a month. They hold them once a week, every single Wednesday night. And on the Wednesday night where the moon is going to be a new moon, where there's not a bright moon in the sky, they set up the telescopes out in front of the planetarium, which is a fairly dark area. And so on a good dark evening, 10 of their members will set up their telescopes. And you can count the line, look for each one of them, if you know what I mean. Some of them are binocular telescopes. Some of them are huge. Some of them are medium-sized. And so I think that club has got over 100 members, and about 25 or 30 of them will show up at any one of their Wednesday night meetings. Paul had a question. WS2N, K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah. They did a renovation in March. They completed it, $10 million, some huge amount of money for this. Got the exact amount, but for the planetarium itself, big improvement, real nice, comfortable seats, wheelchair people in there. I was there in the summer. Naturally, the place is really quick. First class. Right here on Long Island. Thank you, Ben.
Paul just said, and that is the Centerport Planetarium, the one in Centerport, Long Island, that's the town, and it's the Vanderbilt Planetarium. They did a very large renovation in the last couple of years. I am guessing that someone made a large financial contribution to the Vanderbilt Museum. The Vanderbilt Museum and the Vanderbilt Planetarium are side by side in Centerport. It shows up in any of the good road maps in the area. It's north of 25A by about 2 miles, and I can't think of the name of the street it's on, but it's one of those peninsulas going north into the Atlantic Ocean, into the Long Island Sound, and that Centerport is east of Huntington. Yes, Centerport, I think, is between Huntington and Port, if I remember correctly. Anyhow, so because of their renovation, they've made it a hell of a lot nicer. Got a great big telescope, and you can get a free access. You don't have to be a member just to show up to any one of those meetings on Wednesday night at 8:30 of the Astronomical Society of Long Island. And if you Google the word ASLI, where they do it. From time to time, they meet at a parking lot. Jones Beach, Park at night. Some of their members go to the Great Big Telescope Conference that's held in Stellafane in Vermont once every year. So their website will give you quite a bit of information. And with any further comments and questions with reference to astronomy, give me a call at us right now. H-U-R-I-W-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R-U-S-E-R- November Zulu. I'm hearing you on the input, so go right ahead and give us your question or comment. Alpha November Zulu, K2RIW.
I'm a new ham. I was just listening to the repeater. I haven't actually been on it before. I was wondering if this is a regular nut and if there's regular topics to talk about.
You didn't repeat your call letters, Alpha November Zulu. What you're listening to is the technical net. It has been meeting every single Sunday night, starting at 8 o'clock, for 31 solid years. 31 solid years, the technical net meets on Sunday night. and I, for those 31 years, have been one of the major net control operators of ANZ. And this is TechNet number 1493 of the series that began in roughly September of 1982. It's intended to be educational. It's primarily on the subject of ham radio. However, we all recognize the fact that ham radio operators are very curious people, and they get involved in other kinds of science. Astronomy is one of those. We tend not to have any particular subject that is dedicated ahead of time for technical net. The subject to be discussed are the function of when the guys sign in, what question are they asking? And they're asking the question of the whole group because this particular repeater, at Limark in Queens covers quite a bit of northern Jersey, southern New York, and western Connecticut, as well as a good section of Long Island. We know that there's a hell of a lot of brain power in that tri-state area near New York City. So for 31 years, guys have been gathering. People come and ask questions, and usually somebody in that brainy area will come forward and say, hey, I've got some experience in that particular subject. I've done this, I've done that. This is what worked, this is what didn't work. And we share that information. Now give me your full call letters and name. I know you've signed in before, and I'm so forgetful. Alpha November Zulu, take it. K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's DOCA3ANZ, Victor Alpha 3 Alpha November Zulu. My name is Bill, actually transmitting out of Wasega Beach, Ontario. I thought this was a repeater up in Edgar, but you say you're out of the States there.
Okay, now I've heard your full call letters. Victor Echo 3, Alpha November Zulu, and I think you said your name is Bill from Ontario. Yeah, there's quite a few guys from the Ontario area in the Gulf Horseshoe area signing from time to time. Jim, VE3JIW, Scott, VE3ZTZ, Julian, VE3X-Ray Sierra Hotel. So quite a few of those guys have been signing in over the last year or so, Bill. And so this repeater is located on Long Island, and by way of EchoLink and IRLP, various repeater groups in the United States and a few foreign countries will sign into the right node so that during the technical net Sunday night, 8 o'clock, local time, New York City, they're able to hear what goes on. Maybe that answers some of your questions, Bill. BE3, Alpha November Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Correction, VA3, Victor Alpha 3 Alpha November Zulu. Thank you very much. It does. I'm interested. I've just actually started learning about the IRLP, and there's been a couple local guys here giving me a hand with some of that. I just got licensed up in December, and I've started looking at all the IRLPs. I actually have an EchoLink, started playing around with that. I'd love to hear more about it sometime. I won't interrupt you now for tonight, though. It sounds like you guys are having a good time. I'll continue to listen and enjoy. Thank you very much for your information and giving me your time.
Very fine, Bill. Victor Alpha 3, Alpha November Zulu. Got you right this time. KQRIW. And congratulations on getting your license in September. And I think you're going to like ham radio. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, Bill. The people who have introduced you to the hobby didn't tell you that. Maybe they didn't even know it. 26 different general. And so VHF 2-meter repeater type ham radio. You're listening to right now. It's just one of the 26. and if for some reason it does leave you, we do get a certain amount of clearance down here on the New York area that we're working on, and so other than that, but, people like it, but if not, before you give up the hobby of ham radio, a very educational hobby, make sure you try one of the other 25, a few of the other 25. As I see it, the schools in the United States, probably Canada, many places in Europe, do a very poor job explaining antennas is a bit of a crime. They're stuck in the traditional ways of doing things. As it is right now, if you want to hire an engineer, understands antennas, and can design antennas for you, in my opinion, 80% of the time, you have to hire a ham radio operator, enthusiastic ham radio operator, who has been tinkering with antennas in his backyard, on his tower, on his rooftop, on his balcony of his apartment or of his house, and that's where the antenna knowledge is coming from.
Problem with the Kenwood 440 HF rig.